teeth. An excavation of the grounds around that foundation uncovered partial skeletal remains of at least 10 children. DNA testing of their extracted teeth traced their genetic lineage to West Africa. In other words, to the slave trade. Madeline's gaze was fixed on Thrasher with a growing revulsion. Gurney broke the silence. Are you suggesting a connection between the house you're talking about and what we found here? The similarities between your excavation, even in this early stage, and the Marley Mountain site are striking. What are you suggesting we do? I'm suggesting we bring in the appropriate archaeological equipment and personnel to explore the site with the thoroughness it deserves. The more hard evidence we can find to document the existence of psychopathic elements in the treatment of slaves, the more accurate the historical picture becomes. Now Madeline spoke up. How sure are you? About the abuse and murder of slaves? 100%. No, I mean, how sure are you that those things took place here on our property? To be absolutely sure, more digging will be necessary. That's why I'm here. To explain the research opportunity and enlist your cooperation. That's not my question. Based on what you've seen, how sure are you, right now, that the kind of horrors you described actually occurred here? Thrasher looked pained. If I had to assign my opinion a level of confidence, based only on what's been unearthed so far, I'd put it around 75%. Fine, said Madeline with a brittle smile. That leaves a 25% chance that whatever is down there by the pond has nothing to do with the serial murder of slave children. Is that right? Thrasher let out an exasperated sigh. More or less. Fine. Thank you for the history lesson, Doctor. It's been very enlightening. David and I will discuss the situation and we'll let you know what we decide. It took Thrasher a moment to realize that he'd been dismissed. 52. The charged silence that followed Madeline's final comment persisted long after Thrasher had departed. It reminded Gurney of the silence in their car on the way home from a medical appointment years earlier, during which he'd been informed that the results of an initial MRI had been inconclusive regarding a possible cancer, and that he'd need to undergo additional tests. Such a disturbing subject, such a major unknown, so little to be said. They hardly spoke at all during a brief dinner. It wasn't until Gurney began to clear the table that Madeline commented. I hope what I said to him, the way I said it, isn't going to create a problem in your professional relationship. He shrugged. It doesn't make much difference how he feels about me. She looked doubtful. He carried their dishes to the sink, then came back and sat down. 25% is a lot, she said. Yes. So there's a good chance he's wrong. Yes. She nodded, appearing comforted that he'd agreed, even if he'd done so without much conviction. She stood up from the table. I have some watering to do while it's still light out. The new delphiniums from Snooks were looking droopy today. She slipped into a pair of clogs by the French doors and headed for the flower bed, calling back over her shoulder. Leave the dishes in the sink. I'll take care of them later. He remained where he was, immersed in dreadful images raised by Thrasher's comments on the malignant synergy between psychopathic obsessions and the availability of purchasable victims to satisfy them. There was a particular horror in the mundane practicality of buying human beings to torture or kill. He tried to imagine the unique terror experienced by those in that helpless position. The terror of being under the absolute control of another person. His phone rang, a welcome distraction. It was Hartwick.
Shit, Gurney, I'm impressed that you took my call.
Gurney sighed.
Why is that, Jack? According to Ram TV, you're a man destined for greatness.
What are you talking about?
Newsbreakers just did an interview with Corey Payne. He told the world you saved his life, but that was nothing compared to what Stacy Kilbrick said about you.
What did she say?
Oh, I wouldn't dream of spoiling the surprise. All I can say is that I feel privileged to be speaking with a man of your caliber.
Gurney's customary uneasiness at any public mention of his name was amplified by the fact of its occurring on Ram TV. It certainly wasn't something he could ignore, particularly after Marv Gelter's comments at lunch. He went into the den, accessed the site on his laptop, and clicked on that day's edition of Newsbreakers. He used the time slider on the video window to get past the promotional graphics to the point where Stacy Kilbrick and Rory Cronk, sitting at their studio news desk, frowning with concern, were addressing their top story. As the audio kicked in, Kilbrick was in the middle of a sentence. "Learned today that there have been two more suspicious deaths in White River. The bodies of Blaze Lovely Jackson, a leader of the Black Defense Alliance, and her sister, Charlize Jackson Creel, were found in their apartment by Detectives Mark Torres and David Gurney, someone we'll have more to say about later in this program. The District Attorney's Office, which is overseeing the investigation, is calling the deaths possible homicides." She turned toward Cronk. "The terrible carnage in White River just keeps going on. What do you think are the chances these possible homicides turn out to be the real thing?"
"My guess would be 99%.
But so far the DA has released very little specific information. I suspect he wants to be absolutely certain before he has to acknowledge two more murders on his watch. Two more murders in a case that was already bizarre." Kilbrick nodded grimly. "On the other hand, Corey Payne, son of the mysteriously missing police chief, was very forthcoming with his own view of the situation."
"You can say that again, Stacy.
I overheard your interview with him, and that young man certainly doesn't pull his punches. Let's show our viewers what we're talking about." The scene shifted to the simple setting in which Gurney recalled seeing Cronk interviewing Klein. The most conspicuous difference now was the camera being positioned to include the interviewer's short red skirt and long shapely legs. Payne appeared somewhat academic in a brown tweed sport jacket, a pale blue shirt open at the neck and tan slacks. His hair was still pulled back in a ponytail, but it looked more carefully combed than Gurney remembered. His face looked freshly shaved.
"What are you watching?"
Madeline's voice behind him at the den door surprised him. He hadn't heard her come in.
"Corey Payne being interviewed on that Newsbreakers program."
She pulled a second chair over to the desk and peered intently at the screen. Kilbrick was resting a clipboard and pen on her crossed legs. She leaned forward with an expression of painful earnestness. "Welcome to Newsbreakers, Corey. I appreciate your coming here today. You've been at the center of the most disturbing criminal case I've ever encountered as a journalist. Among other horrible events, your own father accused you of murder on national television. I can't imagine how that must have felt. We sometimes use the term worst moment of my life loosely, but in this instance, would you say that was true?"
"No."
"No?" Kilbrick blinked, evidently nonplussed. "It was the most infuriating," explained Payne, "but far from the worst."
"Well, that does raise an obvious question."
He waited for her to ask it. "Tell us, Corey, what was the worst moment of your life?"
"The moment at boarding school when I was told that my mother had died. That was the worst. Nothing has ever come close to that."
Kilbrick consulted her clipboard. "That was when you were 14.
"Yes."
"Your father was already prominent in law enforcement at that time, is that right?"
"Yes."
"And he made a number of public statements blaming illegal drugs, specifically heroin, for her death." She looked up from her clipboard. "Was that true?"
Payne's gaze turned icy.
"As true as blaming a rope for the death of a hanged man?"
Kilbrick looked excited.
"Interesting answer. Could you expand on that?"
"Heroin is just a thing, like a rope or a bullet."
"Are you saying there was more to your mother's death than a simple overdose?"
Payne spoke softly.
"I'm saying that he killed her."
"Your father killed your mother?"
"Yes."
"With drugs?"
"Yes."
Kilbrick looked stunned.
"Why?"
"For the same reason he killed John Steele, Rick Loomis, Marcel Jordan, Virgil Tooker, Blaze Jackson, Charlize Creel, and Judd Turlock."
She stared at him.
"They threatened his future the way he wanted things to turn out."
"Threatened all of that
How? They knew things about him. What did they know? That he wasn't what he seemed to be. That he was dishonest, cruel, manipulative. That he extorted confessions, tampered with evidence, and destroyed people's lives to build his own reputation. To ensure his own security, to prove to himself how powerful he was a truly evil man, a killer, a monster.
Kilbrick was staring at him now in amazement. She looked down at her clipboard, then back at him.
You said, I believe, that he killed Judd Turlock?
Yes.
The information we have from the DA's office is that the Gort brothers are being sought in connection with the Turlock homicide.
My father has always used other people to do his dirty work. The Gorts were convenient tools for dealing with Turlock.
We were told that Judd Turlock was your father's longtime friend. Why would...
Payne cut her off.
Longtime tool and strong-arm man, not friend. He had no friends. Friendship requires caring about another human being. My father never cared about anyone but himself. If you want to know why he would have arranged for Turlock to be killed, the answer is simple. He outlived his usefulness.
Kilbrick nodded, glancing up out of the frame as though checking the time.
This has been remarkable. I have no more questions. Is there anything you'd like to add before we wrap this up?
Yes.
He looked directly into the camera. I want to thank Detective David Gurney with all my heart and soul. He was the one who saw through the framework of false evidence that made it look as though I'd killed those two police officers. Without his insight and persistence, the world might never have known the truth about Del Beckert, the truth of what he is and what he always was, a destroyer of lives, a controlling monster, a corrupter, a killer. I want to thank Detective Gurney for the truth, and I want the world to know that I owe him my life.
Gurney grimaced. The scene shifted back to the studio news desk. Kronk turned to Kilbrick.
Wow, Stacy, astounding interview.
Payne certainly had a lot to say, and he wasn't shy about saying it.
I noticed the name David Gurney came up again in a very favorable way, just like it did in my interview with Sheridan Cline.
Kilbrick nodded.
I noticed that too, and you know what I'm thinking right now. It's kind of a wild possibility, but I'm thinking David Gurney might be a great choice for our next Attorney General. What do you think?
I think that's a fabulous idea.
Okay, said Kilbrick, smiling, turning to the camera. Stay with us. Our next guest.
Gurney closed the video window and turned to Madeline.
I have a creepy feeling that Gelter is using Kilbrick and Kronk to push his AG idea.
You think he has that kind of influence at RAM TV?
I suspect he may own it.
53.
The weather the following morning matched Gurney's mood, gray and unsettled. Restless breezes kept changing direction, pushing the asparagus ferns this way and that. Even Madeline seemed at odds. A mottled overcast was obscuring the sun, and Gurney was surprised to see by the old regulator clock on the kitchen wall that it was already past 9. As they were finishing their oatmeal, Madeline frowned and tilted her head toward the French doors.
"What is it?" he asked.
His hearing was normal, but hers was extraordinary, and she was usually aware of approaching sounds before he was.
"Someone's coming."
He opened the doors, and soon he heard it, a vehicle coming up the town road. As he watched, a large SUV came into view. It slowed and came to a stop between the barn and the pond. When he went out on the patio for a clearer view, he saw that it was a dark green Range Rover, its polish glistening even in the sunless light. The driver emerged, a solid-looking man in a blue blazer and gray slacks. He opened the rear door, and a woman stepped out. She was wearing a khaki jacket, riding breeches, and knee-high boots. She stood there for a few moments, looking around at the fields and woods and up across the pasture to the Gurney house. After lighting a cigarette, she and her driver got back in the big green vehicle. Gurney watched as it proceeded slowly up through the pasture to the house, where it stopped not far from his outback, which by comparison seemed very small. Again, the driver got out first and opened the rear door for the lady, who Gurney could now see was probably somewhere in her late 40s. Her ash-blonde hair was arranged in a short, asymmetrical style that looked expensive and aggressive. After a final drag, she dropped her cigarette and crushed it into the ground with the tip of a boot that looked every bit as costly as her hairdo. As she surveyed the property around her with a dour expression, her driver noticed Gurney standing on the patio. He said something to her, she glanced over, and then she nodded to him. She lit another cigarette. He approached the patio. He had a hard, expressionless, ex-military look about him. For a heavy man, his step was light and athletic. "David Gurney?"
"Yes?"
"Mrs. Haley Beckert would like to speak with you."
"Del Beckert's wife?"
"That's correct."
"Would she like to come into the house?"
"Mrs. Beckert would prefer to remain outdoors."
"Fine, we can talk right here."
He gestured toward the two Adirondack chairs. The driver returned to the Range Rover and spoke briefly to the woman. She nodded, crushed the second cigarette as she had the first, then made her way around the asparagus patch and flower bed to the patio. When they came face to face, she looked at him with the same distaste with which she'd regarded the surrounding landscape, but with an added element of curiosity. Neither offered to shake hands.
"Would you like to sit down?" he asked.
She didn't reply. He waited.
"Who's paying you, Mr. Gurney?"
She had the syrupy voice and hard eyes of many a southern politician. He replied blandly, "I work for the district attorney."
"Who else?"
"Nobody else."
"So this story you've sold to Klein, this fantasy about the most respected police chief in America being a serial murderer, running around, shooting people, beating people, God knows what else, all of that bilious nonsense is the product of an honest investigation?"
Her voice was dripping with sarcasm.
"It's the product of evidence."
She uttered a bark of a laugh.
"Evidence no doubt discovered by you. I've been told that from day one you did everything you could to weaken the case against that little reptile, Corey Payne, and you constantly tried to undermine my husband."
"The evidence against Payne was questionable. The evidence that he was being framed was far more convincing."
"You're playing a dangerous game, Mr. Gurney. If anyone is being framed, it's Del Beckert. I'll get to the bottom of this, I promise you, and you'll regret your part in it. Deeply and permanently regret it."
He didn't react, just held her gaze.
"Do you know where your husband is?"
"If I did, you'd be the last person on earth I'd tell."
"Doesn't his running away strike you as peculiar?" Her jaw muscles tightened. After regarding him venomously for a long moment, she said,
"I was told that a TV news person mentioned your name last night in connection with the election for Attorney General. I don't suppose your interest in that position would explain your attacks on my husband?"
"I have no interest in that position."
"Because if that's what this is all about, I will destroy you. There will be nothing left of you or your so-called super cop reputation. Nothing."
He saw no point in trying to explain his position to her. She turned away and walked quickly to the big SUV. She got into the rear seat and the driver closed the door. A few moments later, the Range Rover was heading silently down the uneven path toward the barn and the town road beyond it. Gurney stood for a while on the patio, replaying the scene in his mind. The strained expression, the rigid body language, the accusatory tone. Having conducted thousands of interviews over the years with the family members of fugitives and otherwise missing persons, he had gotten good at reading these situations. He was reasonably sure that the fury Haley Beckert expressed was the product of fear, and that her fear was the product of being blindsided by events she didn't understand. The cool, humid breezes, though still shifting direction, were growing stronger, creating the feeling of an impending thunderstorm. He went inside and closed the French doors. Madeline was sitting in one of the armchairs by the fireplace reading a book. She'd started a small fire, which was flickering weakly. He was tempted to rearrange the logs, but he knew his interference would not be appreciated. He sat in the armchair that faced hers. "I assume you overheard all that," he said. Her eyes remained on her book. "Hard not to." "Any reaction?" "She's used to getting her way." He stared at the fire for a while, repressing the urge to fix it. "So what do you think I should do?" She looked up. "I guess that depends on whether you see the case as open or closed." "Technically, the case remains open until Beckert is located, prosecuted, and..." She cut him off.
"I don't mean technically, I mean in your own mind."
"If you're talking about a sense of completion, I'm not there yet. What's missing, other than Beckert himself?" "I can't put my finger on it. It's like trying to scratch an itch that keeps moving." She closed her book.
"You have doubts about Beckert's guilt?"
He frowned. "The evidence against him is substantial.
The evidence against his son looked that way, too."
"Not to me. I had concerns about all of it from the beginning."
"You have no similar concerns about the evidence against the father?"
"Not really, no." She cocked her head curiously. "What is it?" he asked.
"Could that have anything to do with your Eureka theory?"
He didn't reply. He knew not to answer too quickly when a question got under his skin. 54. On the occasions when he'd conducted seminars on criminal investigation, he'd always included a discussion of a subtle investigatorial trap he'd named the Eureka Fallacy. Simply stated, it was the tendency to give one's own discoveries greater weight than discoveries made or reported by others, especially if the things one has discovered had been purposely concealed, hence the term Eureka, Greek for "I have found it." A manifestation of the basic human tendency to trust one's own perceptions as objective and accurate, and competing points of view as subjective and prone to error, it could derail an investigation and was responsible for an unknown number of wrongful arrests and prosecutions. Even being fully aware of the phenomenon, Gurney resisted seeing it in himself. The mind has strong defenses against self-doubt. However, since Madeline raised the question, he forced himself to take a closer look at it. Was he, in fact, applying a double standard of credibility to the evidence against Payne and the evidence against Beckert? He didn't think so, but that meant little. He would need to look at the evidence piece by piece to make sure he was subjecting all of it to the same level of scrutiny. He got up from his chair by the fireplace, went to his desk in the den, took out the case files and his own notes, and began what he hoped would be a clear-eyed review. By the time Madeline interrupted the process a little after 12 to let him know she was leaving for an afternoon shift at the clinic, he had reached two conclusions. The first, reassuringly unchanged from what it had been, was that every piece of evidence against Corey Payne could be explained away, and the switched toilet handle was as convincing proof of a frame job as one could imagine. His second conclusion, somewhat disconcerting, was that the evidence against Beckert and or Turlock had the same weaknesses as the evidence against Payne. It was all portable and therefore plantable. Even the items bearing fingerprints, the pen he'd found in the grass in back of the Poulter Street house, the plastic bag at Blaze Jackson's apartment, could have been acquired in an innocent environment for later use in an incriminating one. In short, although there was no proof of it, no equivalent to the switched toilet handle, it was possible that Beckert was also being framed. It was admittedly a rather far-fetched scenario, but the evidence in hand against Beckert wasn't nearly as solid as it seemed at first glance. In fact, a clever trial lawyer might make it appear very shaky indeed. For some time after Madeline left, Gurney remained at his desk, staring out the den window, wondering about the advisability of raising the issue with Klein. It would not be a welcome subject. He decided to speak to Torres first. The call was picked up immediately.
"Hey, Dave, I was just about to call you. Big morning here, a lot of stuff coming in at once. Bad news first.
There was no CODIS hit on the DNA from that used condom found near the Willard Park playground, so that's a dead end. But finding an eyewitness to what went down that night was always a long shot anyway. Now the good news. We got a report from the Albany computer lab on the laptop you found under a mattress in the cabin. Key discovery was a series of searches on brain structure, specifically something called the medulla oblongata, and the extent of protection afforded by adjacent bone structures. The kind of information and anatomical diagrams someone might need if they wanted to drive an ice pick into someone's brainstem. It looks like a solid link between Beckert and the attack on Loomis. Gurney wasn't sure how solid it was, but it certainly was suggestive. And that's not all, continued Torres. The lab sent us a report on the phone that was taped to the bottom of one of the footboards. The call record confirms Payne's explanation for why he was in the Bridge Street area the night Steele was shot. He claimed he'd gotten a series of texts, setting up a meeting behind the apartment building, then moving it to the other side of the bridge, then canceling it. Those texts were sent from that phone you found in the cabin. Interesting, said Gurney. Klein have any reaction to that? He's a happy man. He says it feels like we're finally tying the bow on the package. Gurney's idea of a bow on the package would be a credible confession from Beckert. Klein's use of that wrapped-up image to describe the accumulation of a few extra pieces of portable, plantable evidence seemed to make the search for the perp a postscript. That could turn out to be a major mistake. Gurney ended his call with Torres and entered Klein's number.
David, what can I do for you?
The man's hurried tone suggested that nothing would be the only welcome answer.
I want to share a concern.
Oh? There was more anxiety than curiosity in that single syllable. I've been thinking about the evidence that appears to incriminate Beckert.
Appears to?
Exactly. The evidence against Corey Payne had weaknesses that a defense attorney could have exploited at trial, successfully, in my opinion.
Your point being,
the evidence against Beckert has some of the same weaknesses.
Nonsense. The evidence against Beckert is overwhelming.
That's what you said 3 days ago about Payne. Klein's voice was tight and cold.
Why are we having this conversation?
So you don't walk into a courtroom thinking you have more than you do.
You're not suggesting that Beckert is being framed just like Payne was, are you? Tell me you're not that crazy.
What I'm telling you is that your case isn't the slam-dunk affair you think it is, from an evidentiary point of view. Klein cut him off.
Fine, point taken. Anything else?
Hasn't it occurred to you that there's too much evidence? He could picture a half-angry, half-puzzled frown on Klein's face in the ensuing silence. He continued.
Framers want to make sure their targets look guilty as hell, so they overdo it. I can't prove that's what happened here, but you shouldn't dismiss the possibility. Your possibility is the craziest hypothesis I've ever heard. Just listen to yourself. You're saying that someone framed Corey Payne for the sniper attacks on Steele and Loomis, then framed Del Beckert for the same attacks? Plus those on Jordan and Tooker and Jackson and Creel? Have you ever in your life heard of any case remotely like that?
No.
So? You just dreamed up the least likely scenario on God's earth and decided to drop it in my lap?
Look, Sheridan, I'm not saying I understand what this White River mess is all about, only that it needs to be investigated further. We need a full understanding of who did what and why. It's vital that Beckert be located and—
Hold on. Hold it right there. Our goal is not a full understanding of anything. I administer a process of criminal investigation, indictment, and prosecution. I'm not running the ultimate truth psychology club. As for finding Beckert, it's possible we never will. Frankly, that wouldn't be the worst thing. He can be indicted in absentia. If the case were to end with him seen as a guilty fugitive, that would be an adequate conclusion. A well-publicized indictment can project the same sense of law enforcement success as a guilty verdict at trial. I'll just say one more thing. It would be inadvisable for you to go public with your baseless double-frame theory. It would do nothing except create more chaos and controversy, not to mention a loss of credibility for this department and you personally. Our discussion of this topic is over.
In retrospect, Gurney found nothing surprising in Klein's reaction. Having the case careen around another curve was simply not acceptable. Klein's own public image was his ultimate concern.
Procedural smoothness was a key goal. Surprises were unwelcome. Yet another course reversal was to be avoided at all cost. If anyone were going to upend the case once again, Gurney realized he was the one who would have to find answers to the questions raised by his own unlikely hypothesis, the first of which was the most baffling. Cui bono? To whose advantage would it be to frame both Payne and Beckert? 55. Despite Hardwick's sometimes grating skepticism and verbal abuse, Gurney respected the intelligence and honesty that made him a valuable sounding board. Rather than trying to explain his new concerns by phone, he decided, after checking with Hardwick to make sure he'd be home, to drive to his place in the hills above Dilwheat later that afternoon. The challenging grin that Gurney knew so well was already on the man's face as he opened the door. He was holding two bottles of Grolsch. He handed one to Gurney and led the way to the small round table in the corner of the front room.
So, Davy boy, what's the story?
Gurney took a sip of his Grolsch, set the bottle on the table, and proceeded to review the range of his own doubts and speculations. When he was finished, Hardwick stared at him for a long moment before speaking.
Am I hearing this right? You're suggesting that after someone framed Payne for the whack jobs on the cops, he also framed Beckert for the same shootings. What the hell for? As a backup if the first frame fell apart? That was his fucking plan B? And then he frames Beckert for the Jordan and Tooker murders as well, and for Jackson and Creel?
I realize it sounds a little off the wall.
A little? Makes no fucking sense at all. I mean, what the hell kind of a plan is that? And who on earth would benefit from it?
That's my basic question. Maybe someone who hated them both and didn't care which one went down? Or maybe someone trying to drive the ultimate wedge between them? Or maybe someone who just considered them convenient scapegoats?
Maybe, maybe, maybe.
Hardwick gazed long and hard at his Grolsch.
Look, I get the fact that somebody framed Payne. You can't argue with the toilet handle. But what makes you so sure that Beckert was framed, too? The fact that there's too much evidence against him? That's got to be the most absurd reason I've ever heard for assuming a suspect is innocent.
It's not just too much evidence. It's that it's also convenient. Even the full metal jacket rounds with perfect ballistic markings, and the ease of... Gurney's voice trailed off. Hardwick looked up from his beer bottle.
What's the matter?
I'm thinking about the ease of recovering them. We've been thinking of that as a lucky break. But what if that was the shooter's intention?
His intention?
Remember the thing in the steel video that bothered me, the laser dot?
What about it?
The delay. The 2-minute delay between the sniper getting the scope dot on the back of Steele's head and the fatal shot. Why did he wait so long?
Who the fuck knows?
Suppose he was waiting for Steele to pass in front of that pine at the edge of the field.
For what?
To ensure that the bullet would be recoverable. Hardwick's default expression of disbelief was on full display. Gurney went on. The same logic could apply to the Loomis shot, except in that case it was more rushed, with him coming out of his house and heading for his car. That shot happened with the front door post just behind him. Another easily recoverable round. I was there when Garrett Felder dug it out. Same thing again with the shot at the back of my house. Another intact round, easily recoverable from the porch post. Hardwick made his acid reflux face.
So you've got 3 situations with a common factor. But that's no proof of anything. In fact, it sounds like the kind of shit lawyers focus on to mindfuck a jury.
I know it's not conclusive. But it seems very convenient to have recovered 3 perfectly intact rounds with clean ballistics linking them directly to a rifle in Beckert's cabin. Gurney paused before going on. It's like the plastic bag with the money. Why plastic? Well, unlike some paper, it just happens to hold a perfect print. Anyone with access to Beckert's home or his office could have taken a plastic bag he'd used for something else, then later put the money in it and left it in Jackson's apartment.
And the killer just pops into Beckert's kitchen, takes a bag out of his refrigerator, makes sure there's a good print on it, then heads for Jackson's place and...
Gurney cut him off.
No, I'm thinking this whole White River thing was planned way ahead of time. There was nothing spontaneous or opportunistic about it. It was just made to look that way. Think about it. A white cop being shot at a racial demonstration, followed by a pair of black men being beaten and strangled, followed by another white cop being shot. The Black Defense Alliance being blamed for the shootings, along with Corey Payne, and the white supremacist Gort twins, along with the so-called Knights of the Rising Sun being blamed for Jordan and Tooker, followed by our discoveries at the gun club, the rifle, the rope, the branding iron, suggest that Beckett and Turlock carried out all four murders and framed Payne and the Gorts. But what if all that evidence at the gun club was planted there? The whole damn thing shows signs of having been meticulously constructed. Layer upon layer of deception, all orchestrated in advance. We peel away one false layer and we discover another false layer. I've never seen anything like it.
Hell of a summation, said Hardwick sourly. It's just missing a couple of details, like who the fuck did all that orchestrating and what the fuck was the purpose of it all.
I can't answer those questions, but I do know that if someone was trying to frame Beckett, he must have had access to Beckett's cabin. Maybe we could start with that.
Oh, sure. Look into the least likely possibility first. That makes a shitload of sense.
Humor me.
Fine. Let's get it over with. Call his wife. She'd probably know who he was close to.
Gurney shook his head.
Haley Beauville Beckett sees everything that's happened in White River as a giant conspiracy, with her husband as the victim and the rest of us as the conspirators. I doubt at this point she'd give us the time of day. But Corey might know some names.
Hardwick sighed impatiently.
Fine, call the little fucker.
Gurney took out his phone. As he was looking for Payne's number, he heard soft footsteps coming down the stairs from the second floor. A few seconds later, Hardwick's on-and-off girlfriend, Esty Moreno, entered the room. She was a strikingly attractive young woman, all the more attractive at that moment in remarkably abbreviated shorts, a tight T-shirt, and glistening ebony hair still wet from the shower. She was also a tough undercover cop.
David, nice to see you.
Hello, Esty, nice to see you too.
Don't let me interrupt you, I just came down for one of those,
pointing to Gurney's Grolsch. She passed through the sitting room and went into the kitchen. Gurney made the call to Payne.
I have an urgent question, Corey. Do you know if your father ever brought other people out to the gun club, other than you, other than Turlock?
There was a short pause.
I'm pretty sure every hunting season he'd have his special people out there.
Special people?
The people who could be useful to him. That's the only thing that ever made anyone special to him.
And those people were who, exactly?
D.A. Klein, Sheriff Clouts, Mayor Shucker, Judge Puckett.
Anyone else?
There was another short pause. Yeah, some rich guy, Marvin something, obnoxious billionaire over in Lochinvary.
Gelter.
That's it.
How about people in the department? Anyone special there?
Obviously Turlock. Also a captain and a couple of lieutenants who did pretty much whatever he wanted them to do.
Like what?
Concocting phony cases against BDA members, lying in court, shit like that.
How do you know this?
Some BDA people told me. That's the kind of stuff that Steele and Loomis were looking into, and Jordan and Tooker, too, which is obviously why they were all killed.
I need their names, the captain and his lieutenants.
Joe Belts, Mitch Stacker, Bo Luckman.
Gurney made a note of the names. Do you know anyone else who might have had access to your father's cabin?
I don't know. His wife, I guess.
One more question. Did your father own any other real estate? Summer house, another cabin somewhere, anything like that?
Not that I'm aware of, but that doesn't mean anything. My father is an iceberg. Most everything about him is below the surface. Why do you ask?
Missed a place he might be, somewhere to stay out of sight. How about rentals, leases? A place he might have used on hunting or fishing trips.
I don't think he liked fishing.
Okay, Corey. Thanks for your help. If you think of anyone else who might have had access to his cabin, let me know.
Absolutely.
Gurney ended the call. Hardwick raised his Grolsch and took a long swallow.
That little fucker any help?
Yes and no. Apart from a growing list of unpleasant individuals, any one of whom could have seen where Beckert kept his cabin key, I'm not sure I know much more than I did before. I should get back to Mark Torres, see if he knows anything about Beckert's associates.
Goddamn waste of time.
Hardwick punctuated his comment by putting his bottle down on the table with noticeable firmness.
Focusing on people with access to the cabin isn't relevant to anything other than your double-framing idea, which is definitely on the batshit end of the hypothesis spectrum.
You may be right, but there's no harm in asking the question. He took a sip of his Grolsch and placed the call to Torres.
Mark, I'm trying to get a sense of the people Beckert was close to. I was given the names of three members of the WRPD command staff, Belts, Stacker, and Luckman. What can you tell me about them?
Torres's initial response was an uneasy hesitation.
Wait a second. Just making sure there are no open ears nearby.
Okay.
I can't really tell you much beyond the fact that they spent a lot of time in Beckert's office, more than most of the guys who report to him. Maybe it's my imagination, but they've been looking pretty nervous since he disappeared.
They need to be questioned.
Do you know if Klein's gotten to them yet?
I don't know. He's not telling us much. How many people does he have working on Beckert's disappearance?
Actively searching for him?
None, as far as I know.
His priority is totally on the physical evidence side.
You think that's a mistake?
Frankly, yes. Beckert's connected to everything that's happened, and his role in the case may not be what it seems to be. Locating him could resolve some questions.
What do you think we should be doing?
Everything possible to find him. I'd like to know whether he owns any other property in this part of the state, someplace he might go if he didn't want to be found.
We could have our county clerk check for his name in the property tax rolls.
If you can free up a couple of uniforms, you could have them check the adjoining counties, too. They should also check the names Beauville, Turlock, and Blaze Jackson. She seems to have been involved from the beginning.
Okay, I'll get someone on it.
Before you go, a question about the silent alarm system at the cabin. You told me there was some password protection on the list of numbers it was programmed to call.
Right.
And computer forensics did get back to us on that. There were three cell numbers. Beckert's, Turlock's, and an anonymous prepaid. No way to track that one.
Not to its owner, but to its nearest cell tower when it received the alarm call. That could be helpful.
In fact, you ought to get the receiving locations of the other two as well. Be interesting to know if Beckert was still in the area that morning when Turlock was killed.
No problem. I'll get in touch with the phone company right now.
After Gurney ended the call, Hardwick asked,
"Where do you think he is?"
"I have no idea. Just a hope that he's still in the area."
"Klein's got an APB out on him?"
"Yes, but that's about it." Gurney paused.
"I've been thinking about something you told me last week, about Beckert's family problems. You mentioned that the boot camp school he sent Corey to was down south. Do you know where in the south, or what the name of the school was?"
"I could find out. I know the state police guy who recommended it to Beckert."
"I was wondering if it might be in Virginia, like Beckert's own prep school and his wife's family. It's a state he might know well and head for if he wanted to disappear for a while."
Hardwick eyed Gurney over the top of his Grolsch bottle.
"What are you suggesting?"
"Just thinking out loud."
"Horseshit. You're asking me to explore this Virginia possibility, start checking out all the places Beckert could be, which would be an enormous pain in the ass."
Gurney shrugged.
"Just a thought.
While Torres is checking tax rolls in the towns around here, I'll be looking into rentals. There are no public records arranged by tenants' names, but Acme Realty might have a searchable database of renters in the White River area. I'll drop in on Laura Conway tomorrow morning."
"What's the matter with the phone?"
"Face-to-face is always better."
56. Gurney was the first one up the following day. He'd had his initial cup of coffee and put out the bird feeders before Madeline appeared for breakfast. She had her cello with her, which reminded him that her string group was booked for a morning concert at a local nursing home. While she was preparing a bowl of her homemade granola, he scrambled three eggs for himself. They sat down together at the breakfast table.
Have you spoken to Thrasher? She asked.
No, I wasn't sure what to say. I guess we need to discuss it.
She laid down her spoon. Discuss it?
Discuss whether or not to let him go ahead with his exploration of the site.
You really think that needs to be discussed?
He sighed, laying down his fork. Okay, I'll tell him the answer is no.
She gave him a long look. We live here, David. This is our home. He waited for her to go on, but that's all she said. The interstate portion of the drive was, as usual, relatively traffic-free. He pulled over just before the White River exit and entered Acme Realty's address in his GPS. 6 minutes later, it delivered him to a storefront on Bridge Street, less than a block from the first sniper location. He found that fact interesting, then dismissed it as one of those coincidences that usually end up meaning nothing. He'd learned over the years that one of the few investigatorial mistakes worse than failing to connect crucial dots was connecting irrelevant ones. He got out in front of the office and began to examine the listings that filled the windows. Most of them were properties for sale, but there were rentals as well, both single-family homes and apartments. The area covered by the listings extended beyond White River into neighboring townships. The front door opened. A rotund man with a chocolate-brown toupee and a salesman's smile stepped out.
Beautiful day.
Gurney nodded pleasantly. The man raised a chubby hand toward the listings.
You have something in mind?
Hard to say.
Well, you've come to the right place. We can make it easy. That's what we're here for. You interested primarily in buying or renting?
Actually, I've already spoken to Miss Conway. Is she in?
She is. If you're already dealing with her, I'll leave you to it. She's one of our finest agents.
He opened the door.
After you, sir.
Gurney walked into a carpeted area with an empty reception desk, a water cooler, a bulletin board with notes tacked to it, and two big tropical plants. Along the back of this area was a row of four glass-fronted cubicles with a name on each. He'd been imagining someone young and blonde. Laura Conway was middle-aged and dark-haired. She was wearing colorful rings on all 10 fingers. A bright green necklace drew attention to her already eye-catching cleavage. When she looked up from her desk, her earrings, gold discs the size of silver dollars, were set swinging. She greeted him with appraising eyes and a lipsticked smile.
"What can I do for you on this gorgeous day?"
"Hello, Laura. I'm Dave Gurney." It took a moment for the name to register. The wattage of the smile dropped noticeably.
"Oh, yes, the detective. Is there a problem?"
"May I?" He gestured toward one of the two spare chairs in the cubicle.
"Sure."
She placed her hands in front of her on the desk, interlocking her fingers. He smiled.
"I love the rings."
"What?"
She glanced down at them.
"Oh, thank you."
"I'm sorry to be bothering you again, Laura. As you may have seen in the news, this crazy White River case just keeps getting crazier." She nodded. "Have you heard that we're trying to locate Del Beckert, the former police chief?"
"It's all over the news shows."
"Right. So here's the thing. We suspect he might still be in the White River area. We're checking to see if he owns any local property. That's easy for us to do, but he might be renting a place, and there are no public records of renters for us to check. Then I recalled someone telling me that you folks manage most of the rentals around here, so I figured if anyone could help us out, it would be you." She looked puzzled.
"What kind of help do you want?"
"A simple tenant database search. Beckert may have leased a place himself, or he could be staying in a house or apartment leased by someone close to him. I'll give you a few names, you run them against your master file of tenants, and we'll see if you get any hits. Pretty straightforward. I already know about the apartment on Bridge Street and the house on Poulter, so I just need to know about any others beyond those." He added, "By the way, that necklace you're wearing is gorgeous. It's jade, right?" She touched it gently with the tips of her fingers.
"The highest quality jade."
"Well, that's obvious. And it goes beautifully with those rings." She looked pleased.
"I believe appearances matter. Not everyone today agrees with that."
"Their loss," he said. She smiled.
"Do you have those names with you?"
He gave her a piece of paper listing Beckert, Beauville, Turlock, Jackson, and Jordan, plus the three ranking WRPD officers whose names Payne had provided. She placed the paper in front of her keyboard, frowned thoughtfully, and got to work. A quarter of an hour later, the printer came to life. A single page slid out, and she handed it to Gurney. "Beyond the two you mentioned, these are the only three rentals that come up in connection with those names." The first property was a one-bedroom apartment on Bacon Street in the Grinton section of White River. It was on the top floor of a building owned by Carbo Holdings, LLC. A one-year lease in the name of Marcel Jordan had begun 4 months earlier. The agent's name was Lily Flack. Her notes indicated that the full $4,800 annual rental had been paid in advance in cash by the tenant's representative, Blaze L. Jackson. The second property was a single-family house in a place called Rapture Hill. It had also been leased 4 months earlier for 1 year from the foreclosed properties division of a White River bank. The name of the lease-signing tenant was Blaze L. Jackson. The agent, Lily Flack, noted that Ms. Jackson had paid the full amount of the lease, $18,000, in cash. The third property was an apartment in Grinton, leased to Marcel and Tanya Jordan 6 years earlier and renewed annually every year since. That one didn't strike Gurney as having any relevance to Beckert's possible whereabouts. The other two locations, however, seemed worth looking into. He folded the sheet and put it in his jacket pocket. Laura Conway was watching him carefully. "Is that what you wanted?" "Yes," he said. He made no move to get up from his chair. "Is there something else?" "The keys to the first apartment and to the house." Her expression clouded. "I don't think we can give out keys." "You want to ask your boss about that?" She picked up her phone, then she put it down and left the cubicle. A couple of minutes later, the man who had greeted Gurney on the street appeared in the doorway, lips pursed. "I'm Chuck Brambledale, the manager here. You asked Laura for keys to two of our rentals?" "We may need to enter them, and we'd rather do it without causing excessive damage." His eyes widened. "You have warrants?" "Not exactly, but I understand we have a cooperative agreement." Brambledale stared into the middle distance for a few seconds. "Wait here." While he was alone in the cubicle, Gurney got up and examined a framed award on the wall. It was a Tri-County Association of Real Estate Professionals certificate recognizing Laura Conway as Salesperson of the Year 10 years earlier. Brambledale reappeared with two keys. "The silver one is for the apartment, top floor 4B. The brass one is for the house up in Rapture Hill. You know where that is?" "No." "It's an unincorporated locality north of White River. You know where the gun club is? Well, it's just 2 or 3 miles farther up. Past Clap Hollow?" "Between Clap Hollow and Bass River, middle of nowhere." He handed the keys with obvious reluctance to Gurney. "Weird place." "How so?" "The property was once owned by one of those end times cults, which is how it got named Rapture Hill. And then the cult disappeared, right off the face of the earth. Got raptured up to heaven, some folks said. Other folks said the cult somehow ran afoul of the Gort twins, and they're all buried somewhere up there in the quarries. Only thing anyone knows for sure is that there was nobody to pay the mortgage, so now the bank's got it. Hard to sell with the isolation and the peculiar history, so they decided to rent it." "The flowers are amazing." Laura Conway appeared beside Brambledale. "The house itself is kind of plain, but wait till you see the flowers."
"Flowers?" said Gurney.
"As part of our management service, we check on our rental properties at least once a month, and when we were up there 2 months ago, we discovered that the tenant had Snook's Nursery put in these beautiful beds of petunias, and lots of hanging baskets in front of the house."
"Blaze Jackson hired Snook's Nursery to plant petunias."
Conway nodded. "I guess to cheer the place up. After that disappearing cult business, it always felt kind of spooky up there."
"Blaze Jackson? Petunias?" Mystified, Gurney thanked them both for their cooperation and returned to his car.
Although the Rapture Hill property was certainly more intriguing, it made logistical sense for him to visit the Bacon Street apartment first. He checked the printout Conway had given him and entered the address in his GPS. He arrived there in less than 3 minutes. Bacon Street had that universal quality of run-down areas. The brighter the day, the worse it looked. But at least it had escaped the arson outbreaks that had made some Grinton streets uninhabitable. The building number he was looking for was in the middle of the block. He parked in a no-parking zone by a hydrant and got out. It was a convenience when one was on police business, with the downside that it announced that one was on police business. A man with tattooed arms and a red bandana on his head was working on one of the ground floor windows. He commented as Gurney approached.
"Nice goddamn surprise."
His voice was rough, but not hostile.
"What's the surprise?" "You're a cop, right?"
"Right, and who are you?"
"I'm superintendent for all the buildings on this block. Paul Parkman is the name."
"What surprised you, Paul?"
"In my memory, this is the first time they sent anyone the same morning we called."
"You called the police? What for?" He pointed to a pried-apart security grating on the window.
"Bastards broke in during the night, Bacon apartment, nothing to steal, so they shit on the floor. Two of them. Two separate piles of shit. Maybe you can get some DNA?"
"Interesting idea, Paul, but that's not why I'm here."
"No?"
He uttered a sharp bark of a laugh.
"Then what are you here for?"
"I need to check one of the apartments, top floor, 4B. You know if it's occupied?"
"Yes and no."
"Meaning?"
"Yes, there's officially a tenant. No, they're never here."
"Never?"
"Not to my knowledge." "What is it you want to check? You think someone's dead in there?"
"I doubt it. Any obstructions on the stairs?"
"Not to my knowledge. You want me to come up with you?"
"No need for that. I'll call you if I need you." Gurney entered the building. The tiled foyer was reasonably clean, the staircase adequately lighted, and the all-too-common tenement odors of cabbage, urine, and vomit blessedly faint. The top-floor landing had been mopped in the not-too-distant past, and the two apartment doors on it were legibly marked, 4A at one end, 4B at the other. He pulled his Beretta out of its ankle holster, chambered around, and clicked off the safety. He stood to the side of the 4B door and knocked on it. There was no response, no sound at all. He knocked harder, this time shouting, "Police, open the door!" Still nothing. He inserted the key, turned the lock, and pushed the door open. He was struck immediately by the musty odor of a space whose windows hadn't been opened for a very long time. He clicked the safety back on and slipped the Beretta into his jacket pocket. He switched on the ceiling light in the small entry hall and began making his way around the rather cramped apartment. There was a small eat-in kitchen, a small living room, and a small bedroom, and a closet-sized bathroom, all looking out over a weedy, vacant lot. There was no furniture nor any other sign of habitation. And yet, Blaze Jackson, supposedly acting for Jordan, had paid cash for a year-long lease. Had the place already served some purpose and been abandoned? Or was it intended for some future use? He stood at the living room window pondering the situation. The view from that window included some of Grinton, some of Bluestone, a narrow slice of Willard Park, and, he'd almost missed it through the hazy glass, the front of the police headquarters building. As he watched, a uniformed cop came out the main door, got into a squad car in the parking lot, and drove off. His mind jumped to the obvious explanation that the apartment had been leased as a third potential sniper site. Why the other two had been used instead was a question that would need more thought. At the moment, however, it was outweighed by his desire to visit Rapture Hill. Perhaps when they were considered together, the purpose of each location would become clearer. 57. Gurney by nature tended to go where his curiosity drew him without being overly concerned about backup. Oddities and discrepancies attracted his attention, arousing a desire to examine them more closely, even under conditions that might give others pause. In fact, it was his intention to proceed directly to the house at the end of Rapture Hill Road, and no doubt that's what he would have done if Madeline had not called while he was on his way. She said she had no special reason for calling him, just a free moment, and was wondering what he was doing. As he answered in some detail, she was silent. He sensed the situation he was describing was making her uncomfortable. Finally, she said, "I don't think you should go there alone. It's too isolated. You don't know what you could be walking into." She was right, of course. And while at another time he might have dismissed her concern, he was now inclined to be guided by it.